around the world. So thanks for listening, and thank you for being a part of the UPRNTalkRadio.com family of listeners.
You are listening to United Public Radio Network, UPRNTalkRadio.com, 107.5 New Orleans.
You are invited to the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show every Friday night on United Public Radio Network from 9 to 10 p.m. Pacific Time, 12 to 1 a.m. Eastern Time, with your spiritual warrior goddess, Kathy Bilski. Kathy will share all the old truths the Illuminati tries to keep secret. Kathy also gives you the opportunity to join in with planetary healing light work that will help us manifest World Enlightenment 2016. So let's get high and fly into new possibilities. So join Kathy every Friday night on UPRN, the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show, a very powerful happening.
You are listening to United Public Radio Network, UPRNTalkRadio.com, 107.5 New Orleans.
Spaced Out Radio is glad to be part of the United Public Radio Network family as we round out your night 7 days a week starting at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. Our goal is to give you that paranormal listening option that you've been missing all these nights. You can join me, Dave Scott, Monday through Friday, and James Tyson on the weekend. We promise to deliver the fastest 3 hours of radio right to wherever you are. And
yeah, I'm feeling good right now. It's just one of them days where everything going right. Everybody come together, let's go, yo.
Hey, I'm feeling alright. Just one of them days, everything go right. I like to keep this vibe throughout the day, if that's okay.
Well, aloha, everybody. This is Kathy Bilski, the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show on UPRN Radio. And this is December 16th, 2016. Tonight, I have a really awesome show. I have Mary Olson with me tonight from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And she's going to give us an update on everything that's going on with our water and transportation of nuclear. And welcome, Mary. I'm so glad you're on tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me here and for being here, Kathy. You give people a tremendous opportunity to connect across the world.
And you've got so much information to share. I'm very honored to have you on my show.
No, thank you.
Can you give me us a little background about you?
Sure. I started out in a family which was very focused on the world and keeping health and balance and peace foremost. And my father was an evolutionary biologist, and I went off and ended up studying the same field. And in the course of starting a research, I wouldn't say career, because I was still working on other people's projects, when I had a radiation accident at work. I was 25 years old, fresh out of college, just a couple years out, and it made me leave biological research and go off to recover, because I thought about doing a legal action in relation to that event, because I got contaminated and really had my what shall I say, my rear kicked by this dose of radiation, changed life. But I decided instead of taking that legal action, I wanted to recover. I wanted to get well. And after 5 years, I found out that the federal government was thinking about deregulating radioactive waste, about a third of the so-called low-level waste, which is everything in the nuclear industry and the nuclear weapons complex that isn't a fuel rod. Now, later tonight, we're going to be talking about fuel rods, but entire nuclear reactor buildings and even the vessel and you know, all the tanks for holding the waste for making bombs, all of that is considered so-called low-level waste. They were going to allow about a third of that to be deregulated, put into regular landfills, and recycled into consumer products. That was 1986. It started, and I found out about it in 1990, and it made me drop everything. I had to respond. I couldn't imagine somebody in Kmart or Sears or Target or any of those commercial outlets where we buy our stuff possibly bringing home something that would contaminate them like I went through from that job.
I remember that, though, and I was, they were thinking about making forks and spoons out of this waste. And
anything metal could have had it.
And vegetables.
Yeah, and baby cribs and zippers. We always like to talk about the zippers because some people care the most about what's behind the zipper. But, you know, that's a joke mainly. But anyway, anything. And especially today, there's a bunch of metal in the weapons complex that's nickel that they want to deregulate. Where would that go? Into all the batteries that are powering our cell phones that we hold up to our heads and our laptops that we hold on our laps. And, you know, we work hard to keep those things from happening. So the we there is that I got a job all those years ago, 26 years ago now, with Nuclear Information and Resource Service, which is a small outfit, but it does have supporters and members in all 50 states, I'm proud to say. And we've been around as an organization for coming up on 40 years. So I've been part of it for about, well, over half of it. And I think we've done some pretty darn good work. Because they haven't regulated that waste. We were in the forefront of helping people across the country to unite and make darn sure that that didn't happen in the early 90s.
Well, with Trump coming into power, and I want to choke on that, how do you feel that's going to change how you look at everything that's being done now, and do you think you're going to have to fight harder?
Well, we are going to have to fight harder no matter who came into power because of some fundamentals, and we can get to that, but I want to speak to the issue of Trump. His cabinet is a complete disaster for the future of our children, our grandchildren. If these people's policies come to sway, the things that we have worked so hard for across the board in the environmental community are going to be literally flushed down the toilet. On the other hand, if Mr. Trump himself triggers a big enough crisis in our constitutional democracy, maybe they'll all be so busy with the legalities and the, quote, swamp that they won't get around to the details, and maybe we won't have to, I don't know. I mean, one of the big things we went to 2 weeks ago at a major strategic meeting about all this is we do not want to trigger the avalanche. If the avalanche is coming, we have to be ready to respond. But it's quite possible that they're all going to be so busy with their own little and enormously huge geopolitical intrigues that they don't actually bother with things like nuclear waste. We don't know. But the fact that Perry is in place as the energy chair kind of squashed that idea. We're pretty sure that if he manages to figure out which way the paper is pointing up and can read the print on it, that he'll start implementing some of the disasters that were coming out at the end of the current administration. And in addition, we've had a bulldog in the Senate for decades from Nevada, who was helping to keep nuclear waste where it is today rather than turning it into a shell game, which is what we're here to talk about a little bit tonight. This is the whole idea that just moving it is going to improve it, but not changing the technology that's being used to store it. I mean, just moving it is an improvement. Hello, on our highways and railroads. Hello.
Well, when you're,
let me finish the thought. That Harry Reid was able to stop that from happening for a very long time by holding the purse strings. No funding for anything that had to do with the high-level waste. And Harry retired. And so regardless of who is going to be president, we had a huge, huge watershed with his departure.
Yeah, when you're talking about moving the nuclear waste, are you talking about what they want to move from Canada down south?
Oh, it's the same kind of stuff, but that stuff's the worst. Maybe we should start with the very worst. What I am broadly talking about tonight, I mentioned the deregulation of so-called low-level waste, and that was the first big campaign I worked on, and we pretty much stopped that policy. That's everything but the fuel rods. Now we're going to turn to talking about that very fuel, atomic energy, whether it's for weapons or for electric power, is, you know, comes out of the heat that's released when atoms are split. And not only heat is released, but there's new radioactivity that's formed, millions and millions of times more radioactivity than the uranium that comes out of the ground. And that is the highly radioactive either fuel rods or residues from fuel rods, because they chop them up and dissolve them, like up in Canada, that's what they have, is liquid highly radioactive waste, not fuel rods, but the leftovers of what was actually not a rod, it was called a target. But in any case, it's this same kind of waste, but it's liquid, and that is what they plan now in the Department of Energy and their counterpart in Canada to ship by truck. And it's going to take between 100 and 200 trucks, so it's not just a single shipment, between Ontario and South Carolina on common-use interstates and other roads. And they want to start it in February. We're in court, along with a large list of allied organizations, to say, no, this has never been done. It shouldn't be done. There's better alternatives that could be stabilized in Canada and stored there. There's absolutely no legitimate reason to subject the entire eastern seaboard and the states in between to this highly, highly risky activity.
Can I just say one word, insane?
Insane. And you know, the only thing we can find as a motive at all is a relatively small amount of money. Yes, it's in the millions, but not a lot of millions, that the folks in South Carolina at the Department of Energy site would get for putting this waste into their processing facility. And they're trying to keep that facility going. They want the lights on there, and so this is like a little teeny mission for it. But compared to what? Just a single accident, or even, not even an accident, the radiation that will come through these containers and out to people who happen to be in the next lane. Now, that's not very big if you're both moving. But in this area of western North Carolina, we get tie-ups on the interstates all the time. There's rock slides. There's accidents that might not even include the radioactive shipment, just cause it to sit on the road for periods of time with cars on either side and people getting radiation without knowing it and no benefit to them. And there's no reason for that.
It's a scary thought.
Yeah.
Would they mark the trucks? I mean, that's what they
have. Little placards, little teeny ones, you know, the little radiation symbol. But it's not like there'll be some public service announcement that says stay off the highways. And these things are very attractive nuisances, you know. If somebody wanted to be malicious, that's a very bad story that I don't like to dwell on, but it's important to raise because our members of Congress from New York State have asked for a security review before these shipments happen, and our lawsuit asks for an environmental impact statement because there wasn't a full environmental review either. And yeah, those are tactics to slow it down, but once all the governors in between and safety officials get wind of this, we hope there'll be enough friction for the Department of Energy to decide their little bit of money and their little bit of waste is just not worth it. Because it isn't.
Why is this not talked about at all? Do you think there's a nuclear blackout?
Sure. There's always been a nuclear blackout. That's why my organization survives on crowdfunding, and at some point I'm going to tell you the place to go if people want to pitch a nickel in, because, you know, there's no major funding for people who are willing to stand up to these industries, because they're all tied up with our biggest corporate interests that have built nuclear facilities, whether they were commercial or defense, the Westinghouses and the GEs and the Exelons and, you know, all those major, major industrial interests who fund a lot of our politicians. We're the little guy, but a lot of little guys and girls standing together over time have made a huge difference, and that's why we go charging out there and find a pro bono attorney and get the case filed. We had a little evening here in Asheville with maybe 20 people turn out, and we raised the $200 for the part of the court filing fees. So, you know, it's just a little bit here, a little bit there, and together we managed to do some pretty big stuff.
Wow. Let's talk to you. What's going on with the Yucca Mountain? Wasn't that supposed to be done? And explain to people what they want to do there.
Yes. I'm going to turn to Yucca Mountain, but can I make one last point about why these shipments really have to get our attention?
Yes.
Okay, and that's my current work on radiation impacts. It turns out that with 60 years of data from the horrific event of dropping nuclear weapons on cities full of people in Japan, there was data collected on the survivors. And with that 60 years of data, we can now say that there is a gender difference in radiation harm. And that even women my age exposed to something like that truck in the next lane for a couple of hours may, it doesn't mean everybody will get cancer, that's not what I'm saying, but the risk goes up, and my risk, even at this age, is 50% higher than a man my age. But little girls, compared to little boys, it's double. And little girls compared to the adult males who work in the nuclear industry for the most part, it's 10 times higher, Kathy. 10 times higher. All of our estimates on radiation harm are way off because they've never, ever factored the entire human life cycle in the findings. And I made this finding 6 years ago, and we just have more and more and more information that it's sound and correct. Another individual had made the same finding in the same data set 5 years before me, and somebody has come after both of us. So we now have three different researchers looking at the same data set who can say that gender is a factor and age is an even bigger factor.
And didn't you mention that when they do these, I don't know what your brain doesn't want to think about, what you call them, a report that they're based on radiation on a man?
Yeah, they call it the standard man, and they invented him during the Manhattan Project when they were sending military, almost exclusively male people and paramilitary people, into restricted zones that had barbed wire around them, and the radioactivity that they were working with was inside those zones. Now, of course, I'm leaving out the miners who were not protected, who also were deeply harmed by this, but they too were primarily males. So in that picture, they got no information about what the impact is if you expose a child or a boy child versus a girl child. And this is one of the relics of that horrific act of destroying cities with atomic weapons, is that the survivors were of all ages and both genders, and they've now been tracked for 60 years. And we can say unequivocally that there is a gender factor. And that's not being taken into account by the Department of Energy when it thinks about sending these trucks down our roads. So that's where I'm taking your time now to say, hey, this point has to be looked at, because I expect grandmothers and grandfathers and mothers and fathers listening to this to consider the fact that their children need protection that our government is not offering them. And we know this, but in this case, it's unbreaking news here.
You know, I've heard governments lie and lie and lie and lie. And just recently, I heard news about Chernobyl, and that was another nuclear accident. Was it in Russia?
Yes. It was in the former Soviet Union and is now on the border between Ukraine and Belarus, on the same
and
physical location, right?
They have a scientist coming out and saying how much they actually lied about, you know, what happened and how much affected people and still affecting people.
Still affecting people. And two-thirds of the radioactivity from that event, because it was a fire, that reactor burned because the material in it was combustible for 10 days and spread radioactivity across all of the Northern Hemisphere, but especially Europe, and two-thirds of it was not in the immediate area of the reactor. Over time, the uptick in cancer across those regions will to some degree be due to Chernobyl. There's a lot of controversy about how much. The lowest estimate is 3,000 cancer deaths from that one reactor burning for 10 days and spreading its radioactivity. That's a lot of people, but that's the low estimate, and estimates go up to 3 million. So somewhere between 3,000 and 3 million extra cancers from one reactor, whereas the Fukushima site, of course, had three reactors meltdown. So
it has to stop.
Yeah. I mean, we have other ways to make electric power. And we don't know what to do with the waste, which takes us back to your question a moment ago of Yucca Mountain. Shall I jump there?
We seem to tie it right up
okay.
there pretty well.
Okay. So Yucca Mountain is a sacred site of the Western Shoshone people. It is part of New Segovia, which is their traditional lands, which are much larger than any recognized treaty lands. Reservation lands. These are treaty lands. And the Western Shoshone maintain that that treaty is still in force. And I want to focus on this for a second because the United States wouldn't be the United States without the Treaty of Ruby Valley. The government of Abraham Lincoln needed money. They had gold they were digging up in California. They tried to bring that gold by water, and they got bandits in the waterways that stopped them from going that way. So they struck this treaty with the Western Shoshone to protect them across their lands to bring the gold back to Washington to pay the troops to win the Civil War. So the Western Shoshone stand by their treaty and say, hey, this mountain's part of our land. In any case, the state of Nevada also, which it is located within the jurisdiction of Nevada, also opposes this site for nuclear waste. And in fact, no waste has ever been taken there. People have been hearing about Yucca Mountain for so long, they assume that waste has gone there. Indeed, no. I have been on the beat for 20 years along with a small handful of other leaders and thousands of people nationwide, and we have managed to stop every single proposal that would have taken waste to that site, and for a good reason. There's a magma pocket below Yucca Mountain. It's about the last place we should ever put this waste into tunnels in the ground. It's just not viable. So regardless of people saying it's sacred land or the state of Nevada having the right to say no or any of the other factors, the technical aspects of the site are worse than
leaving it. So you're saying
leaving
that that's a volcano.
Well, you know, you live in a place that is a series of eruptions from a single hot spot.
Okay.
They're called the Hawaiian Islands. And the Earth moved across that hot spot and made the chain of islands. They're lava cones. And the same thing is true in Nevada. There's a row of lava cones. And the youngest of the cones is not that old. And it's in a row that points directly to exactly where they dug the, they only have one tunnel that's basically an entrance tunnel. They never created the full repository at Yucca Mountain before they stopped about 8 years ago, any activity there. So there is a tunnel, but it's not where the waste would go. But in any case, these lava cones are the oldest is furthest away and the youngest is closest. And they point in a direct line to where they dug that tunnel in Yucca Mountain. And the GPS systems that they now use to track the expansion of the Earth's crust that's typical for a hot spot shows that Yucca Mountain is, in fact, having crustal expansion, which would go along with having the magma pocket right below it.
We call him so scientist. He just wants to say, smack my head.
Well, you know what? It was Congress who chose that site. There was no geologist involved. They just said, screw Nevada. And that's a long, interesting political story from Capitol Hill. It has nothing to do with geology. They only had one member of the House and two senators. They were very weak, and there were three sites on the chopping block, and the other two were, one was in Washington State, where the majority leader was from, and the other was in Texas, where the Speaker of the House was from, and those very powerful people participated in what was openly called in 1986 Screw Nevada. And they just drew a square on the map and said somewhere in there, and they wanted to keep it off the Nevada test site because of national security. They didn't want all the workers going on and off the test site. They had to keep it off Nellis Air Force Base because of all the planes coming and going, and so they just stuck it over in this corner on BLM land with no geologists involved at all. So it's a bad site.
Like, I smacked my head.
And we've spent $12 billion determining what some of us knew just by looking at that row of lava cones. I mean, a good geologist can read the land, and many of them said, no, not there. But once you've got an enormous federal agency deciding this is their solution to an interminable problem, I mean, radioactive waste ain't going away. It's going to be a hazard for a million years and more.
We've talked, you know, about the ways, but can I jump, because it's kind of just to something really practical, and I want to bring it up because you brought it up, and that's how you've got to be very, very careful about different stones being radioactive. And many people now are starting to get stone countertops. And, you know, what we say, some of the worst ones that are actually radioactive, slightly radioactive, is granite and marble.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Granite more than marble, but some marbles, yes.
I have to tell you, I went into a Panda Express, and they have granite tabletops all over. They probably have 15. And, you know, usually it's get and go for me, and my friend and I were together, so we decided we're going to, you know, eat in.
Uh-huh.
We both started to get physically ill. And
yeah.
I looked at her, and we went outside, and, you know, I was getting a headache, I was getting foggy, and, you know, she was having different reactions. And as soon as we went outside, it cleared up. Now, what really I'm just even thinking now is, how is that radiation affecting the food on a daily basis?
Well, there's all of those questions, and they're perfectly legitimate, and I think some people are a lot more sensitive to immediate symptoms than others are. I don't doubt for an instant that you experience that, and other people might be in the same place and not even notice it. Or attribute it to something else. So, you know, it's hard to say unless you have an instrument that can actually measure things.
Well, if you think having, you know, like 20 tables together and they're really thick. And,
yeah,
you know,
no,
they're
I hear
good
you.
Size.
I hear you. I go to hotels and they have granite all over the bathrooms and I'm like, oh, God, don't. You know.
If it wasn't for our conversation, it wouldn't have been, I wouldn't have understood.
Right.
What's giving me a reaction?
Yeah.
And, you know, we wouldn't have thought, well, let's get out of here. And then, you know, it clear up and you're going, okay. God, I want a Geiger counter for Christmas.
Well, Amazon has some. I actually really recommend building your own. There's a kit on there that some friends of mine in around the world, really, but primarily in Tokyo, Japan, developed. And the beauty of that particular SafeCast model is that it's mappable. It goes up to a Google Earth mapping, and you can report the location and the date of your measurements. And I think that's great, because now we have a fleet of instruments that are all calibrated the same, and you can compare readings. So many people who have detectors, they're unique, and they can't compare it to any other kind because they're all calibrated differently, so they get a reading, and it just doesn't make sense because they don't understand that the other instrument is like speaking a different language. So I'm big on this idea of let's all have similar instruments so that we can compare our data. But if you just want to know if the counter is hot, all you need is something relatively simple, and you can get those as well. They cost less, and Amazon has a pretty interesting selection, or you can find them elsewhere online.
Well,
but I think everybody should have one.
The point that you even need one when you go grocery shopping?
You know, that's more complicated. Most Geiger counters can't pick up radioactivity that's inside of food or water unless it's extremely concentrated and penetrating radiation that comes through the containers and things like that. It doesn't mean there isn't radioactivity in the food. It's just that a Geiger counter is not terrifically helpful. Most of that detection has to be done with a laboratory. It's expensive. It takes time. Those laboratories exist in Japan. I wish there were more of them. There's a really great independent one in France. Actually, I hear there's two now in France, and there's a great one out in Massachusetts in the United States, but it's just one guy, and he's not well-funded. And so the rest of us are flying blind because there's virtually no place that will analyze the kinds of samples you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a new business. Dang.
Yeah, it could be. It like could be, and in some areas it should be. There are areas of this country where uranium mines have been abandoned, and the levels of radioactivity are higher than what is around in Fukushima Prefecture in contaminated zones. I mean, there's a lot of concern about what happens when somebody digs this stuff up. The uranium is mixed with all of these other radioactive elements like thorium and highly radioactive stuff that can be very dangerous, and then the rain is affecting it differently than if it had been left alone in the earth, and water supplies are getting contaminated because of these abandoned mines, and very often it's low-income rural people, whether they're Native American or transplanted peoples from wherever, but in any case, they are very often living with direct exposures to these materials. And this is the front end of the fuel chain that then supplies the electric power. 20% of U.S. electric power is from splitting atoms. The state of Hawaii, and there are about 20 other states that don't have any reactors, so it's not every place, but most of the East Coast, the states have nuclear power, and that places everybody at great risk.
Well, is it true that the states let the utilities bill the consumers for new reactors before they're even built?
Many places have this policy. It is a state-level policy called construction work in progress. And yes, there are people today paying on their electric bill for things that they will never get any benefit from. Elders who may not live long enough before the reactor comes online, people who will relocate before the reactor comes online. And there were 99 reactors in the past that were under construction that got canceled. And they were canceled because at that time it was clear to the vice presidents in charge of investments and finance that nuclear really was not a very good investment. And today the energy from wind and from solar power comes in at about one-third of what people have to pay for new nuclear power. So tell me that nuclear is a competitive way to address anything, whether it's our electricity, our energy security, or even the climate crisis. It's not cost-effective, and it's just plain, you know, a welfare program for these industries that don't know how to transition to a new model.
Well, how do you feel about reactors being safe?
I, as a scientist, will tell you that if you are creating a potential, it is there 24/7. And in the case of reactors, the potential is meltdown and disaster. There is no reactor that does not have that potential. There are supposedly safer reactors in the world, but all of them result in so much heat in its fuel that if it's not actively cooled, which is what stopped at Fukushima, you know, the pump stopped, the electricity went out, the generators were actually lost in the tsunami. So when the cooling stops, even when the fission process, which is the splitting of atoms, when that stops, the fuel itself is still so hot, it will melt of its own heat. And that melting is what releases so much additional radioactivity in gaseous form into our air and results in the water that comes through becoming so contaminated that it also is the threat that then, you know, results in massive exposure to our environment and to people. So that potential is at every single reactor site. And it remains with the fuel pool as a potential until 20 years after you turn the darn thing off. So we've all somehow been hoodwinked into agreeing to this picture as normal or just doing business. And I reject that notion. I don't think it's normal. I don't think it's just doing business. I think we have every reason to turn off the coal plants, every reason to turn off the nuclear plants, and the good news is that we can do that now. We have alternatives that are in place, that are industrial scale. We can be smarter with our use of energy so that the stuff that's being poured out the leaky windows and the uninsulated roofs, we know how to fix all that. And it's good jobs. You know, it's healthy jobs compared to the radioactive jobs. So I don't think we should be afraid to stand up and say we can have a carbon-free, nuclear-free future. We really can, and we can have it today. California is moving that direction, and New York State would have been, but they just sold out to the Exelon Corporation and are giving billions in bailouts from the electric customers to keep old reactors operating that are getting more dangerous by the minute. And New York could have gone for solar and efficiency and wind instead. And it's really sad they didn't. I think it's just fear.
Don't you think it's more just money and, you know, people?
Yeah, old boys networks. I mean, as I said, fear. My goodness, if those planes had hit the Indian Point reactor, which is, you know, four air minutes from where the World Trade Center was in 2001, if they had hit the nuclear reactors instead, Manhattan would still be uninhabitable for, you know, centuries and probably millennia. And the U.S. couldn't have recovered from that, you know? So, safe? Give me a break.
Okay, so how can people donate to you?
We're running a crowdsource campaign that appreciates gifts of any size online. You just put in nuclear is dirty as one word. Nuclear is dirty, and it comes up, but it's nuclearisdirty.nirs.org. And for people who prefer to send something in the mail instead of doing it online, you can go to nirs.org, and the contact information with the mailing address is there. And again, gifts of any kind are appreciated because we have a challenge grant going on right now, so every dollar will be matched, and that runs through the end of the year.
Awesome. Come on, everybody. Yeah, it's a worthy cause, and, you know, she's speaking up for everybody and her group. What in the world would you say, you know, in the 60s, everybody stood up against nuclear, and we thought it was all over.
Well, yeah, it's been really interesting because there was an enormous partial victory in the 70s, At the time that Nuclear Information and Resource Service was founded in 1978, just the year before Chernobyl, which was a meltdown too, people covered that one up pretty good, but in any case, there were over 400 reactors that were either already online or were, you know, under construction or had a name and a license to build it. And only about 120 actually were ever built. If you add the little tiny research reactors, it goes up to 132, I think. I don't mean the campus research reactors, but there was a generation of tiny reactors before they started building the big ones. So 132 out of over 400. So a lot of it just stopped. And it stopped because of the money. It stopped because of Three Mile Island. It stopped because coal was cheap, and that's a very sad thing, that suddenly we were putting all that carbon in the air instead of splitting atoms. I'm not proud of that. But it wasn't our community that said coal's better. It was, you know, the work of saying nuclear is dangerous. So here we are, all these years later, 40 years later, and obviously coal is also dangerous, and obviously we need to be phasing that out. But if you're trying to understand that our planet is in crisis because of the carbon stuff, then you want to be as smart, as fast, and cost-effective as possible. And even MIT says that it's going to take close to $3 trillion for a 1/12 offset of the carbon, and that was, you know, numbers that are a while back, so it'd be even less than 1/12 today of the solution from building new reactors. And you'd have to bring a reactor online, I think it's one a week between now and 2050 to meet that goal. And the mistake that I have to say, I think has been made over and over by many people, is that when we complain that $3 trillion is too much money, well, the corporate side hears that and goes, ooh, goody, sure. We'd love that money. We don't care if we deliver a solution because this climate thing is a hoax anyway. But we'll take your money. And Bill Gates is one of those people, and he's just announced a big, huge billion-dollar investment fund, and he's taken the name Breakthrough, which is the name of the people who are trying to promote nuclear energy, as if it would be a solution. And all I can say is that we have to start remembering that little girls are our future. There's nobody listening who didn't come from a little girl. And little girls are not about billions of dollars or trillions of dollars. They're about being healthy and being able to grow up safe enough to be able to have their babies in the future. And if we can shift the conversation away from how much money is involved on either side of the equation and take it to health, I think that we unequivocally can say we cannot afford in human terms any more Fukushimas, any more Chernobyls, any more Three Mile Islands. Nuclear is dirty.
But then you look at it from the reptilian point of view, and they want 90% of us gone to begin with, so they don't care if we humans can reproduce or not.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that, I've run into this idea that the population explosion, which is real, somehow a nuclear birth control is a good idea. Well, I'm a biologist, and I'm here to tell you that an explosion, like, you know, going to 7 billion people when in 100 years ago we were at a fraction of that, tiny fraction of that, it's not going to be a gradual decrease in population, likely. A gradual decrease is not very likely. Some kind of crisis or another and population crash is more likely. And I'm not talking about next year or the year after or even in 10 years. But at some point in our future, it's very likely that for whatever reasons, disease, famine, war, large impact, solar storm, I don't know, something is going to crash the population. And if that happens, then barriers to reproduction begin to dictate what the outcome is. And if we do not have the ability to have genetic transmission of the human germlines in a population crash. Bye-bye, Homo sapiens. I mean, hello. So we don't have to have a nuclear war to have the nuclear industry jeopardize our future. And it's not only our species, it's all of them. So the more we can do to contain the radioactivity we've already made, not carelessly turn it into a shell game by putting it on our roads and on our rails, where it can get lost, where it can have accidents if you have unnecessary transportation. Probably have to move it someday, but we should minimize that. We shouldn't just move it to move it, which I'm afraid is what Rick Perry and his Department of Energy coming out of the current generation there. They're going to want to move it just to move it. And that's not a solution.
Yeah, let's not talk about them because we could go on for a long, long time. I wanted to get to you about the water and the radiation in the water and the government saying that now it's okay to drink higher levels of radiation.
Oh, I think you're talking about something that came out of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And this is what's known as a protective action guide. I wouldn't use the word protective. I would call it a liability limiting guide, because what it is what states and localities can tolerate if there is a spill or if there is a meltdown or a dirty bomb or anything else that spreads radioactivity around. This new set of guides tells them how much people can be allowed to get without being notified, without having to, you know, get them bottled water instead of the water that's available, or without, excuse me, having to be evacuated. So how much is allowed to happen before the local authorities have to intervene? So they call it a protective action guide. I call it a liability limiting guide because, you know, if they meet this, nobody can sue them. But they're going from a safe drinking water level of 4, and I'm not going to put a unit on there because I actually don't think those units matter anymore, but still comparative levels of 4 to 500. That's what this protective action guide allows them to do. And that's thousands of times higher when you go from 4 to 500. It's unconscionable.
Yeah, the whole industry is unconscionable. What do you think about reverse osmosis water?
I am not a water purification expert. I think it'd be great if you got somebody on who knows that stuff. I certainly would prefer to have reverse osmosis or distilled water in an area where there's a big concern about radioactive fallout in rain or a spill that is contaminating groundwater. Certainly after Fukushima, I had those concerns.
What are you talking radioactive about? Yeah, radioactive rain. People may not have heard that before.
Oh, well, nuclear power reactors and nuclear weapon sites are allowed to vent to our air on a routine and ongoing basis, as long as they're within an average over the course of a year, assuming an adult male is the one getting the dose. There's no contemplation that children are breathing the same air or playing in the same rain, because once this radioactivity gets up in the air, if it goes high enough, it can become incorporated into our clouds. Plus, there's other areas where it's actually being vented as radioactive water vapor and radioactive steam. And this is because one of the primary products of an operating nuclear reactor in terms of radioactive waste is radioactive water with radioactive hydrogen in it called tritium. And the tritium releases aren't even really counted when they talk about the amount of emissions that people are exposed to, because they're so ongoing they just can't even keep track of them. So it's a big mess, and there's radioactive rain out there. It's not all rain. It's not everywhere. But when they were testing nuclear weapons in the air, there was a lot of radioactive rain. When I was growing up in Illinois and Indiana, there were big hot spots, and guess who got to know about it? Kodak, the makers of photographic film, because their film could be ruined by the radioactivity exposing the film.
Oh,
so
my
Kodak
God.
Became an insider in the nuclear secrets, and Eastman, it used to be Eastman Kodak, became one of the largest contractors running the nuclear weapons complex. So, hey, those good old boys, they knew how to network.
Oy.
And children who are playing in that radioactive rain, well, good luck. They don't really factor that in the cancer epidemic, but they should.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's, you know, that's my generation. I'm from Michigan.
Yeah.
From Detroit.
You can Google, you know, radioactive fallout. USA Today published the maps, county by county. And I happen to live in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Appalachia, and some of the hottest spots are in these mountains because of the type of weather pattern where the clouds come across and then they hit the higher ground and dump their rain, and so all types of fallout were worse in these mountains.
Wow.
And I want to take it back to the fact that nobody has counted the exposures to little children as being different than the exposures to adults. The harm to them expresses over their lifetimes. So the 10 times more cancer to females exposed as little children isn't childhood cancer. There may be a few childhood cancers in that tally, but most of them are adult cancers across the lifetime. So there's 10 times more in that group of young people across the whole population of females, and 5 times more if it's a little boy compared to a man across the population. So you start being able to understand why there's so much cancer out there, and people are tapping their heads and going, golly gee, but radiation isn't that harmful. It can't be that. Well, they never counted right.
God, you know, they were brain dead when they went to school. I mean,
they didn't know that, Kathy. They didn't have the numbers. The numbers they looked at were all workers, adult male workers. You're not going to find data about children and females in adult male worker populations, and that's who they were studying. You can't really fault them for being anything but, what shall we say, the product of a patriarchy. And I'm not against men, believe me, my favorite people are men. But the patriarchal thinking is that that's all you have to look at. So we have a life cycle that's much more complex than that.
Wow.
Anyway,
Do you think that they're trying to have actually another nuclear renaissance?
Yes. I think that there are people very dedicated to the idea that our future is nuclear. And I think that they are being influenced by corporations that are deeply, deeply invested in not only continuing nuclear, but limiting their own liability. Because, you know, the things I'm saying translate into pretty big consequences. And they want to keep it all rosy and happy and green and clean and, you know, the answer to coal is more nuclear. They want everybody to believe that, so that when they hear someone like me talking, they just go, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. It's safe, it's good, it's clean, it's green, you know. And nuclear is dirty. It is not safe. It is not green. It is not clean. Nuclear is dirty.
Well, I've actually heard people tell me that the third or fourth generation nuclear is supposed to be awesome.
There's a group of people who are reading very short little paragraphs with nice, big, pretty pictures, and they have people who are holding that begging bowl saying, yeah, I want that $3 trillion. Oh, boy, solving the climate crisis with nuclear costs $3 trillion. Yeah, I want that $3 trillion. Rather than hearing the $3 trillion and knowing that if we put that money into efficiency and solar and wind and appropriate hydro and helping people to stop throwing so much stuff away that isn't biodegradable and all the other ways in which we can be lighter on our planet, you know, we could do it for a fraction of that $3 trillion. Truly. That $3 trillion is like enormous overshoot in the money and enormous undershoot in the results. And these poor, dear people who think that they've got the best thing since sliced bread are just playing right into that hoax. It's a money hoax, and it will not deliver the goods. And in the meantime, we are sacrificing our genetic integrity and that of every living system on the planet to generate more radioactive waste. And they cannot use nuclear without generating radioactive waste. And they will say they're going to use the waste up, and that is a fiction, because they always generate more. Always.
We've got 2 minutes left.
Okay, you can shoot again?
You go for it.
We are doing a crowdsource funding for Nuclear Information and Resource Service that I work for. And through the end of the year, it's a challenge grant, a dollar-for-dollar match. You can do it online at nuclearisdirty.nirs.org. You just put in one word, nuclear is dirty. It comes right up in your web browser. Or you can go to our regular website, www.nirs.org, if you prefer a snail mail address to mail a check. Both are eligible for the wonderful donor who's matching dollar for dollar till the end of the year.
Definitely a worthy cause. I mean, she's out there fighting so we don't have the nuclear. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you, Mary Olson, and what your group is doing, because you're out there. You're on the front lines.
Thank you, Kathy, so much for creating the opportunity for me to be here. I appreciate you, too.
Beyond money, do you also need people and volunteers?
Always. I'm in Asheville, North Carolina. The home office is in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and we're more than happy to work with people online, and we do conference calls and occasional national meetings. So get with the activities, and we'll be more than happy to help you be effective.
And you also do a lot of counseling, don't you, and helping other groups?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We are part of a large community. There's no way a small staff like ours could produce the incredible results we've had over the years, stopping new reactors, helping to close old ones, helping to keep the waste out of the Western Shoshone Yucca Mountain. And now there's new challenges, like stopping the liquid shipments from Canada, and they want to send all that irradiated fuel, that high-level waste, to Texas and New Mexico, which we didn't talk about, but we will next time.
Oh, God, it just never stops, does it?
Well, you know, if we're still having this conversation in another 240,000 years, we'll be doing really well. This is a long-term commitment, Kathy.
Without blowing, right?
That's right.
Well, thank you very much, Mary, and I hope you have a really lovely vacation and a wonderful Christmas and holidays.
Thank you. You as well.
And we'll talk to you soon. You will come back.
Thank you so much. Good night.
Good night. Aloha. Have a lovely Christmas, everybody. Have a safe one. Oh, we still have one more show next week. Yeah, I will be here next week. So, we're going to do another light circle, so, you know, tell your peeps about it, and let's make it a big circle, because truthfully, we're fighting Nazis right now, aren't we? That's what's kind of popping up all over the place. And on that happy note, I'm going to say aloha, and again, you have a very safe and lovely and happy week. Aloha.
The Gonsfelds are a very controlled experiment designed to produce experimental results. The remote viewing is, we're going to put this psychic ability to use, and we're going to find out something useful with it. So in remote viewing, you'll typically have two people in the room. Nobody is trying to control for an experiment here. So you have one person laying down, and they're the one that's going on essentially a guided journey, and then you have another person with them that is prompting them to, you know, stay with us, don't drift away too far, keep talking to me so that we can get some valuable information from you. And then so we have a sitter and we have a talker. The talker will tell the person, you know, this is what you need to do. We have this envelope here with this information in it. The envelope is labeled ABC. So tell me what you discover from ABC. And the person laying down, the sitter, will, you know, get themselves into the proper frame of mind and then start talking the images out. It's better if they don't know anything at all about what they're supposed to do, because then they can't get start making stuff up. You know, based upon that, and then if you have enough of these people doing the remote viewing, you can take all that information together and form a more complete picture from it. So it's much different from the Gonsfeld. They're out to find information. They're out to get something useful. They're not going for statistically beating chance. That's not the goal.
Shaker with ice. Combine one and a half.
Let's get to a question from Eric Cooper. He is asking, Craig, what is your wildest psychic ability experience? Is it telepathy? Is it telekinesis?
I had the most powerful one I ever had was, this was during the time when the BP thing in the Gulf of Mexico was going on, and